I should probably start in a way that may seem a little strange to you, but is very appropriate to what we're about to embark on here for the next 50 minutes or so. Grace, mercy, and peace from God our Father and from our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Now, that may be a strange way to begin a lecture, but then this is going to be a strange lecture. A number of you have asked me over the course of the last day or so whether I am a pastor, and the answer is no. I am a minister, and so are you. I am also an artist, and we're going to talk this evening about art and its relationship to the church, and every one of you has an opinion about that, which makes this a very dangerous subject. Every one of you has an opinion. And every one of your opinions is valid, which makes it even more dangerous. And so, grace, mercy, and peace. Please. At the present time, how many of you have ever been on a church building committee? Okay, pretty good. All right. I currently sit on 34. And those of you that have been on one know that it's the closest thing to purgatory this side of eternal life. People will commit murders over the width of sewer pipes in the name of Jesus. It's a terrible thing, most church building committees. Frightening thing. And I think one of the reasons is that they don't take themselves lightly. They take themselves so seriously. As though they were building God's house. I am wont to say on occasion that you know it's God's house because you can drive by at 2 o'clock in the morning and peek through the stained glass and see the light on in there over the altar, which means God's in there, which means we don't have to worry about bumping into him downtown, which is why we have that light, you know, and that's why we call it God's house, and that's why if we're good Lutherans, we keep it locked. Huh? Just try and get into a Lutheran church. Just try. It's terrible. Of course, you can't get into Catholic ones anymore either. People want their stuff. Wouldn't it be wonderful if somebody came to your church and stole a crucifix? And then had it hanging around the house for a while? Couldn't get rid of it? And there was this crucifix? And the poor fella had stolen it? And had to look at it? Wonderful. You should get another crucifix. Let him keep it. Look at it. And be forgiven. We don't realize that the history of the relationship between art and faith in the Christian church is one of absolute hilarity. Delight. Now when I say foolish, I don't mean stupid. Silly, maybe, but not stupid. When I say foolish, I usually mean with high risk. Not totally aware of how things were going to turn out. But I mean some other things as well. And in order to get the definition of foolishness rolling, and just simply because I am in such a South African mood these ever since Lutheran World Federation, I want to play you another song for from South Africa, and this song epitomizes foolishness. I don't know how many of you are aware of what the South African situation is, but it's horrible, it's desperate for the black people. Now here is a song in which they sing, "It doesn't matter if they should jail us, we are free and kept alive by hope. Our struggle's hard, but victory will restore our lands to our hands." Now, if we were singing that, if they had jailed us, if they had killed our leaders, if they had taken away our lands, what kind of tempo would you sing those words in? It would probably be, listen to this. The whole creative process is silly. To put a tune like that, to words like that, is almost rubbing your struggle in your oppressor's face. And I suppose that if we want a model for the foolishness of creation, we need look no farther than the first chapter of Genesis. There is a word that means generous to the point of extravagance. The word is prodigal. And when you look at creation, you have to ask yourself whether or not it's the son that was prodigal or whether it wasn't really the father. Because when you look at creation, it is nothing but extravagant. 10 million galaxies in the cup of the Big Dipper alone, each as big as ours. Who needs it? Who needs all of that? Maybe one star, we could sell it like to an Arab republic or something and get money to take care of the poor. It would never be missed. Just one dinky little star. Those of you that have managed to make it to some upper meadows around here have seen flowers in crazy abundance. And flowers will come into those meadows and they will live and they will die and nobody will ever see them. That's really unnecessary. In fact, the whole creation was unnecessary. I mean, why did God do that? To prove God was God? To who? To show how wonderful God was? And so he puts unnecessary stars in unnecessary spaces, looks out on it and says, it is good. Compared to what? How can even God use a word like good when there was nothing else to compare it with? In only one way does it make any sense, and that is if it made God happy. So God puts extravagant stuff out there, spins it around in a universe in crazy ways. I mean, people, I give you the hippo. And says it's good because it makes God happy. And then says, let's make folks in our image. The image of God is that God is generous to the point of extravagance and does it all through unimaginable imagination for God's own delight. Looks at stars, it is good. Looks at flowers, it is good. Looks at water and land, it is good. And then makes us and repents. And I guess at the basis of it is that we just didn't turn out imaginative enough. Not creative enough. Lost the image. The ability to make God laugh. I can see only one job for the artist. It's a job we all have, of course. And that's to live in the image of God. And an awful lot of the church's history is obviously an attempt to make God laugh. In the catacombs, there are tens of thousands of these things scratched all over the walls, and not one sign of despair. Not one. I mean, if you want to listen to the early church, you listen to the South African singing, it doesn't matter if you should jail us. And the early Christians in the catacombs are singing on the walls, making stupid drawings of birds. Look at that bird. That, if that were a student of mine at the university, that would be a definite C minus, maybe a D plus even. That is a bad bird. But it is graffiti, that turkey. It is just pure graffiti. And it is a celebration of the hope that is in him. It is also a celebration of the language. Can you imagine an early Christian building committee? I guess I can't. Down in the catacombs trying to decide what style to do it in. And they say, well, let's do it in early Christian. Well, for goodness sakes, early Christian was late Roman. Or late Ephesian, late Thessalonican. They already had a visual language. Check this. Evidently, when they wanted to depict heaven, they showed people sitting around tables eating. It must have been rough down in the catacombs, because heaven was three squares a day. And we should also When we talk about Holden being a prefiguration of the coming kingdom, we should note that the early Christians depicted meat on the table. That is such a cheap shot. I don't believe I said that. I apologize. This is wonderful. This is really wonderful. They're sitting around the banquet table, and they're ready for wine. They got their cups up. Cups up, everybody. And the way they did the wine business in those days is that somebody poured a little dollop of wine paste. Sounds horrible. In the bottom of your chalice, somebody else came along and put warm water in it. And then somebody else came along and stirred it up. Okay? So, we have them sitting around with the cups ready. And on the wall is written, Irene Calda. Hey, Irene. Hot water. And over here, Agatha Michemi. Hey, Agatha. Stir it up. You gotta love that. But you gotta love it even more when you find out who Agatha and Irene are. They are Roman goddesses, folks. Roman goddesses. When the Christians get to heaven, they are gonna be waited on Hand und Fuß by the old order. Victorious. All the old gods and goddesses are going to wait on the Christians. They celebrated their faith in their language. How is a Roman going to depict Jesus on the throne of heaven? Floating around up there? No. There's only one way. He's got to be sitting on a throne held up by Zeus, the god of the sky. The sky is a blanket that Zeus holds over his head, and there is Christ on the throne of judgment with his left foot in Zeus's eye, literally making his enemies his footstool. Oh, that's wonderful. That is so wonderful, because it's really hard to separate the Christian from the pagan, isn't it? In a piece like this, you'd have to do some surgical things here, which would ruin the whole thing. It's all together. It's all one language. It's all the celebration of who the artist was and what the artist was learning. When the early Christians found a spot, and they were constantly looking for these little spots where Jesus did some of his things, or if not Jesus, where his disciples did some of their things. Or if not the disciples, where friends of Jesus' disciples did some of their things. And they went around and put X's on all these spots where these things happened. And if you go to the Holy Land, the little guide will just take you from one X to the other. And the history of the Christian church has been the history, at least one of the histories of the church, has been a history of the debate over who's got the right X. If you ever go to the Rotunda of the Anastasis, this place in Jerusalem, three priests from three different Christian religions will tug at you and take you to their X. Hey, over here. We got the dirt. Theirs is covered with marble. We got the actual ground. Not only that, but you come over to this side, and we will sprinkle you with rose water. And it wouldn't cost you a cent. You should come over and enjoy. And so you do. You got to cover all your bets when you go and visit X's. This X business is what we call iconography of place. Because the ground, buildings, trees, they witnessed the acts of Christ and his disciples in their lifetimes. And the word for witness is martyr. Martyr. And so in the early Christian church, we had a cult of the martyria, a cult of the witnesses that celebrated landscape as much as people. Now, when you went to the Rotunda of the Anastasis, where Christ was buried, you know, you go on a pilgrimage, you got to come home, and you know, you all know, especially you grandparents know, you can't come home empty-handed. There are all those little grubby hands waiting out there back home. What did you bring me? Well, this was what they brought the grandkids back in early Christian times. This is a souvenir. It is a vial about the size of a silver dollar filled with oil that burned in the lamps of the Rotunda of the Anastasis at the site of the tomb. Oil! Witness the place, and it became an icon. And on this little vial were little depictions, scenes. And these things spread throughout Christendom, and that's how art got started in early Christian times. But it's really interesting. The artist who did this with Jesus Christ looking like a rather pudgy-nosed, almond-eyed, Middle Eastern prophet cut off at the shoulders is obviously Syrian. At exactly the same time in Italy was that sarcophagus I showed you just before, where Christ sits on the throne of judgment and he's a beardless youth looking very much like an Apollo. It was at this time that one of the popes said, if we were pigs, Christ would have to be a pig. And that's the truth. So they built these little churches over these sites. They even left holes in the floor so you could check out the ground, because the ground was more important than the building. Don't you feel sorry for the Altar Guild? I wonder how many vacuum cleaners they ruin in a year. The problem was they built this thing over the site where Peter and Christ had that confrontation, and Christ said, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I question the exegetics of this architectural interpretation, but the rock is sticking right up through the floor. And that's the way they built their churches. It's a basilica, and they didn't invent it. The Romans had basilicas and the Greeks had basilicas, but from this time until the present day, at least 95% of all of our churches are built on this model, on the basilica model, long and narrow. It is my job to go around to all these churches and try and make them square. It's really tough. And from the outside of the early Christian church, you kind of get an impression of it being something like a bus station. There's not a lot that says, you know, the men meet on Thursday, the women meet on Friday, we have bingo every Wednesday afternoon, and that kind. No big signs. You got to go up to the church and knock. And a little door opens. And, you know, you say, Peter sent me or somebody like that. But it's very hush-hush and secret. On the outside, it looks like a brickyard. On the inside, it's wonderful, full of marble. Marble, by the way. And the early Christians were really good at midnight requisitions. You military guys know what that means. They just went around, you know, they saved having to write copies, you know, requests out in triplicate. They just went and took stuff. They usually took it off of old temples and built the Christian churches out of them. I mean, Christians didn't invent those columns. Those are just ripped right out of a Roman temple. Now, early Christian services were interesting. Women were behind, they had drapes connecting those columns. Women were behind the drapes on one side, men were behind the drapes on the other. Sort of Missouri Synod-ish. Hey, I'm Missouri Synod now. I don't... And the women could look over the drapes and see row of women saints up there. And the men could look over the drapes and see a row of men saints up there. So while things were taking place in the middle, like the instruction of the confirmands, the Christians could be behind there and nobody would know who they were because these confirmands hadn't signed up yet. It's still risky business being a Christian, you know. And so after confirmation class is over, the bishop says, scram, in Latin, dismissa, which is where we get the word for mass, missa. Mm-hmm. The word mass comes from the word scram. And that's right. That's right, because after the people who weren't members of this church were told to leave, then the men and women could come out from behind the drapes and go into the center and celebrate the mysteries. That's right. Talk about closed communion. Whew. I love this. I love this. Here's a row of men saints. The guys are on the other side looking up at them. And there was in the early Christian times a horrible controversy. Arian controversy was a problem about whether to acknowledge that Jesus Christ was actually true man. Arius contended that he fudged a little bit and he kept his godhood handy just to get him out of trouble, like Greek gods did all the time. And so they had to call a council. And they said, this guy Arius is a heretic flat out. We don't acknowledge it and we will say so in a creed. The council, of course, was at Nicaea. And the creed was the Nicene, which says Jesus is true God and also true man. Well, they had churches that the Orthodox would build and that the Arians would build, side by side. Or they would have a church that was Orthodox and then the Arians would move in. After the congregation got too small to support the building project, Arians would move in. They'd look around and say, you got some people up there that aren't our people. Boy, does this sound familiar? You got some folks up there standing in those special niches over there and we don't want them in there. They are not our saints. So they put drapery over them. You gotta love it. There is one fellow, one saint, who was standing there in an attitude of prayer with his arms out. And his arm went over the post. So when they put drapery in between, they forgot to cover his arm. And I don't know if you can make it out, but it's that post. It's the last of the small drapes on the left pillar. There's a hand with a wrist floating in midair. I call him Saint Wrist because that's all we got. But in spite of controversies, he prevails. It's wonderful. It's foolish. The whole thing got moved to Istanbul, Constantinople then. The whole headquarters of the church got moved there. And Constantine started building these wild, crazy, huge things that fell down. I mean, he'd get them up and they'd fall down. Or he'd get them up and they'd catch fire. And so they kept trying to build them. I mean, just going into church was an act of faith. I mean, you never knew whether the whole thing was going to come down. Anya. And the great monument of Byzantium that was rebuilt a couple of times is the Hagia Sophia, which is just an absolute amazing building. If you say, what is the dominant visual motif? I'm going to talk professorial here for a minute. The dominant visual motif for Western thought, it's linear. The dominant visual motif for Oriental thought is circular. The dominant design for Oriental worship places is circular. The dominant design for Western places of worship is longitudinal, linear. Here is a city that is literally in two continents. Half the city, Üsküdar, is in Asia, Asia Minor, and the other half is in Europe, with the Bosporus running right through the middle. And what did they build? A building which is longitudinal under a huge circle. A combination of both of the dominant visual motifs, because it's a place that is half and half. This is the narthex. Can you see the little guy? I should have a narthex. There, see the fellow standing here up against the door? Everything in this picture is either matched marble, 22 karat gold, alabaster, or crystal. In order to make the highest, oh, I love it, but it's a mistake. In order to make the Hagia Sophia, they opened up marble quarries, got the marble out, and then dynamited them shut. So that there is no marble like that anymore. And the big thing that they solved was how to put that dome over a square. that's tricky, you see. I mean, you make it too small and it falls in. You make it too big and it slops over. You know? And you can't just prop it up there. You got to do something kind of neat. Kind of neat. How you get from four corners to a circle. It's very tricky. I will demonstrate. If you can see me, do you see the corner, the two corners back there? On top of the corner is a triangle that goes up on one point, comes out like this, bends forward and leans, like so. Can you see it? Yeah. It's got a mosaic of a seraphim on it. Those are called pendantives. And the pendantive is the invention of the Hagia Sophia. Never happened before. So when you talk about Christian art and architecture, you don't talk about it outside of other contexts like engineering, society, theology, history, economics, politics. All of those things go into the making of Christian art and architecture. And look at the fellow, the Christ. My goodness. Almond eyes, he looks kind of like a Mandarin warlord. He is Oriental. And yet he's got a Greek robe on. He's got a Greek hairdo. But the book is going backwards. You see the book? The book is actually getting bigger as it goes away from us. Can you see that? The back of the book here is big. The front of the book is small. That is reverse perspective. And that's the way the Oriental people draw. For the Oriental people say, we are to the real world as the hub is to a wheel. And the spokes get bigger and bigger as they go away. Whereas the Greek said, man is the measure of all things. And so things get smaller and smaller as they go away. Which is true. Yes. Yes. They're both true. I mean, is the universe getting smaller and smaller as it goes away from us? Absolutely not. But how do things appear as they go away from us? They get smaller and smaller. So, you got to decide whether you're Oriental or Western. Which is more important, what you see or what you know? And in art history, that has been the struggle. That has been the main, not just Christian art history, all art history. Which is more important, what you see or what you know? And Constantine is on the left, giving the city of Constantinople to the Virgin Mary, and on the right is Justinian, the emperor, giving the Hagia Sophia to the Virgin Mary. The last time I was in the Hagia Sophia, I paid somebody about $40 to light all of the lamps so that we could worship there at night. All the oil lamps. And this is just the only picture that came out was of this mosaic lit by candlelight. Look what happens to it. The figures all of a sudden turn into grill work. They become transparent. And the whole Hagia Sophia was like this. You measure the gold set in little cubes, 1/4 by 1/4 by 1/4 inch. You measure the gold by the square acre. Most of Byzantium is tiny, small, intimate spaces. This is probably my favorite of all the mosaics. Look at Jesus. Jesus is in the water, King of creation, so the water rises up to cover his nakedness. But there's another guy in the water. Can you see him? Look at that little guy down there. What is he doing under the water? This church is in Greece. And that little fellow, if you can check it out, is carrying a trident. You remember that? The three-pronged spear? That's Poseidon, the god of the waters. The new god of the waters, the new king of creation, has stepped into the River Jordan, and the old god is hightailing it. And it may look funny, but it's delightful, and it's very reverential. Oh, things get awfully complicated in Byzantium. This is another little brickyard on the outside, and on the inside, every square inch is covered with mosaic. Every square inch. This one building in Ravenna is the subject, just the one building, is the subject of a full year, 2 semesters, 6-credit graduate course at Indiana University. On one building. I don't think I want to know that much about a building, but it's fascinating. That's the ceiling. That's all little cubes of glass, most of it gold. The interesting part is over the altar. Right above the altar is this Christ figure. We're back in Italy, so Christ looks like an Apollo figure. But on the side, we've got the emperor standing with his court. Now here's a real problem, folks. The emperor couldn't be there for dedication. So he sent his mosaic artist to do a portrait in mosaic of him. He's alive when the portrait was done. And he is bringing a paten, a dish to hold the bread. And he is there with his retinue. Now we got some funny things going on for an alive person. First of all, we got a halo. And anybody knows that the first physical requirement for being a saint is deadness. You know, I mean, well, that's, I hope we know better than that. I mean, that would certainly screw up the communion of saints, wouldn't it? But he's taking it awful literally. I mean, there's a big red one right around his head. We don't, you know, if we go to Sears and have our photos taken, we don't expect to stick a circle back there. Not only has he got a halo, but he's got a shield bearer with his monogram on it. And check the monogram over here. Does that look familiar? It's a chrismon, a chiro. And that belongs to Jesus. The emperor is going around with a halo, and his monogram is Jesus' monogram. Now, squeeze your eyes shut quick and tell me how many guys has he got with him. 12. You got it. 12. What's going on here? What is happening? The emperor is Christ. Whoo! And they took it literally. We say it, we confess it, but we don't mean it. Right? I mean, when you call yourself Christian, when you call yourself a member of the body of Christ, what does that mean? What does that mean? For these people, it meant something very special and literal. This is Mrs. Emperor, who was one of the great ladies of all time, Theodora, who has also got a halo. I think it's wonderful. I think I'm going to start doing portraits with halos around them. I think I'll start with a self-portrait and a halo. And look at her robe. See down at the bottom of her robe, the company she keeps? Those are the magi, three wise men climbing up her robe. And she is bringing her gift. She puts herself in the company like the emperor puts himself in the company of Christ. All little cubes of gold and purple and red. This is St. Mark's, another Byzantine church, the scene of one of my greatest disasters. I was working on restoring the mosaics in there and put something in backwards. And it's in there. Had to knock it out, and in the process of knocking it out, something in the ceiling fell down. And so I had to stay in Venice for an extra 6 months. If I had thought fast enough and realized that every time I destroyed something, I got to stay in Venice an extra 6 months, I'd probably still be there. But this church probably wouldn't be. The icon, the image that these people painted in the context of their liturgy is not a picture of Jesus. That is not a picture of Jesus in Byzantine liturgy. That is Jesus. And that's a hard thing for us, and I can't even take the time to explain it to you. I wish I could. It is so complicated, but it has very much to do with the same thing, like word and promise. When that pastor sticks that little wafer on your gullet and it slides down there and he says, "Take, eat, this is the body." And you get a little swig of Manischewitz or whatever it is you use, and he says, "Take, drink, this is the blood." You don't sit there and say, "Hey, that don't taste like that. That don't look like what you just said." It is because of word and promise, and because of the whole company, the body that is celebrating simultaneously. It is. And Byzantium just simply extends the isness business to an awful lot more than we do. I wish we could, because too often on Sunday morning, it all looks like hocus pocus to me, because we don't do it during the week. It's what we call sacramental living, and it's more than just water, wine, and bread. It's us. It's our whole life together. So they made these images, and they got very serious about them. No rule. I mean, no rule would be broken. And the rule book is about 6 inches thick. There was a way of doing these that they started in the 800s, and they're still doing them exactly the same way now. Check this this is the Annunciation. The angel, that was from the 800s. This is from the 1200s. This is from the 1800s. 1,000 years apart, and the angel still has to come in from the left. No change. It's what we call orthodox. And of course, we have trouble with all of that shenanigans, hanging jewelry around, and say, my gosh, you're just putting all that stuff on a picture. To which the icon painter would say, that is not a picture. It is. It is. But they had trouble too, and people started kicking them around, and so they hid away in strange places, outposts like Meteora. Any of you who like to travel, let me know, because we're all going here next June. In fact, all of these places I'm showing you, we're going to go there next June for three and a half weeks. We're going to see how the early Christians made their art. This is the way they solved the parking problem. You drove up, and they lifted you in a basket. I spent 6 months in there studying icons and going through the library. My bathroom is visible from here, but that's another matter. Mm. And this is what we did on the inside. And they're too poor to use gold, and so they use the next most mysterious color. Black. Whew. That's important. There is no text without context. That's true of theology. That's true of the Bible. That's true of art. That's true of you and me. Every time you look at a work of art, you have to understand the context in which it was done. And the context for these things will help you understand that this is more than just simply the picture of somebody who didn't know how to draw. This is a delightful thing. This is done by an Islamic artist, and Islamic people by law are not allowed to make images. But this fellow winds up over in Spain in the company of Christians and becomes converted. And so he turns his faith from a non-image making thing, which is what Islam demands, to an image-making thing, which seems to be what Christianity demands. He couldn't help it, but he had to do it in an Islamic way. And the Islamic way is pattern. I love pattern. This is a great pattern. Looks like he had a hair stamp, and a nose stamp, and a mouth stamp. He had a little hand stamp. He got on a roll with the little feet stamp, and he wound up with 1 foot too many down there. It's he just fell in love with his stamp down there and just ran right off the edge of the page. Oy, yoy, yoy. There's a fellow down in Indiana University that did his doctoral dissertation on this page. This one page. What he was trying to do was unravel this. It's like, you know, painted macrame. And so he was trying to take it all apart. But he had to do it in plastic overlays. His dissertation is about this thick. He found that there are only 5 pieces of string in this whole thing. Just knotted around, going, you know, in and out, changing color. Only 5 pieces of string. This poor fellow is now a ward of the state of Indiana. Yeah, but you got to wonder about the monk that put this together in the first place. People, don't stand up back here. If you can find your way over here, there's sure lots of seats on this side, but I sure feel uncomfortable with you feeling uncomfortable. All these migration people, all these people moving across Europe and Asia, finally come into Europe And they build these things for their own protection, you know, so you can pour boiling oil down on the Christmas carolers and whatever you want to get rid of. And they really were in a sense of defense. First of all, there was a period, the year 1000, when nothing was built because they thought the millennium was going to come and all the buildings were going to be shot anyway. So they didn't build. But then the year 1004 came and they started building like crazy, but they didn't know how. So they would put them up and nature would tear them down, you know, gravity problems and all kinds of structural problems, but they built kind of like the Romans. And because they were very much aware of impending judgment, they put all kinds of scary things on. I mean, it was like they were literally trying to scare the hell out of people, because you walk up to that church and you don't get in unless you get scared. Get really scared. This Christ will be on the throne. Here's a guy who is going to hell because he was a liar during his life, and he is going to spend eternity having his tongue being pulled out, by demons. I cropped this photograph, as you can tell, because of what the dog is doing down in the lower right-hand corner. I mean, it is disgusting. And Christ is on the throne of judgment, meeting out law. So it's sort of like, behave. You better watch out. Jesus is coming to town. But on the same side of that law, business, there is another edge to faith. It's not just awesome. There is a part of it that is giddy, what we tend to sense as foolishness. I mean, the building programs at this time were the most extravagant in history. There is a 75 by 75 square mile area in France which in 50 years built 400 cathedrals during this time. 400! And they were all monastic, so they weren't just churches. They were also hospitals, bakeries, barns, all kinds of stuff. Completely independent from one another. So there was a sense of the awesome and there was a sense of the foolishness. Fear and foolish. And here is Eve. Oh boy, I would really love to have this. I think this could better be done by a woman describing what's going on here, because unfortunately it was done by a man, an artist by the name of Gisobertus, and this is one of my mostest favorite sculptures in the whole world. I like it better than any Michelangelo. Here is Eve, a thoroughly intelligent woman. The way the Germans do it, she's a pot-bellied lady hanging around a tree. But this lady is really something. First of all, she's beautiful. She got her nose busted off, but that wasn't her fault. It was... She is beautiful. She is reaching for fruit, and she already knows. This is not a dumb lady. She knows that it's all gone down the tubes. She is crying. She is crying, and she hasn't even had a bite yet. This is amazing. It is really a tender thing, and it is super realistic. That's a hunk of stone. And on the one hand, she is thoroughly penitent. As though to say, my God, what have I done? And if you look at her at a slightly different angle, whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, where's Adam? This is amazing. This is beautiful. And the same sculptor did some of the most deliciously funny stuff you have ever seen. The flight into Egypt. It's happy time. I mean, they got out alive. Joseph is singing a song, Mary's content, the baby is content, although that's no way to carry a baby on a donkey. The donkey is very happy and should be because the artist has given it wheels. So they are sort of... Three wise men in bed together. I'm not going to say any more about that, except the funniest thing about it all is that this is where they are, people. They are 75 feet up in the air and you can't see them. Oh, remember this when you get to your building committee? The church building is not for the artist's display. Artwork is like a prayer. It should ascend to the throne of heaven like other people's prayers. You don't design a church to be a one-person show. Oh, I wish I could share an awful lot of this foolishness with you, but I have to show you one final picture. And, well, there's the third step into this chapel, this 12-foot drop. That's a... I don't understand that at all. We're getting to the good part now. Oh. Now, this is a very funny picture. I mean, if we asked them all to have a seat, four of those guys are going to land on the floor. The table is set all the way around, but Leonardo has come to town, and he's going to paint their picture, so they all get around on the other side to pose. That's right. This is not a Last Supper. This is a portrait session. It is. Pure and simple. But one thing to leave you with, and I'm going to talk more about this our next session, and this is specifically for you. A congregation in Kentucky asked me to move a stained glass studio into their church because they wanted to do their own windows. They wanted to do their own. And I tried for a long time to talk them out of it because every one of them was over 70. Every one of them. And I thought, we're going to kill each other. But we talked about it, and we finally moved in the stained glass studio, and we did designs of their first church, which was a log cabin, their second church, which was burned to the ground, and so we did a picture on fire, their third church, which was waiting with a big blank space for a big window in the back. And they did 17 of these little windows. And then they decided, we're having so much fun, we want to do the big one in the back. And they did it. They did all. I just did the designing. They put them together, and they installed them. I told you I was going to knock your socks off. And here it is. They not only, every one of them who worked on this project were over 70, but they were all blind. Thank you very much. God bless.